Long live the blink tag, Linux gets infected, and BlackBerry actually making a device that people like? All that and more on the next Longcast. Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Slongcast, episode 18, for Wednesday, November 3rd, 2010. It's November already. Really?
Crazy.
This is crazy. That was my long-time guess.
How many shopping days till Christmas?
Oh, have we started the countdown yet?
I don't know. Well, I mean, why not?
That's true.
It's
why
November.
Not? So let's see, 25 and 25, so 50, 53?
Something like that. Math is hard.
Yeah, I can't do math off on the spot. That, ladies and gentlemen, is my longtime co-host, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Howdy.
And I am Kevin Slonka, as always. My name hasn't changed. I don't think it's going to anytime soon. Hopefully not. I'm not one of those weirdos that likes to change your names.
Like Prince.
Yeah, like Prince. Seriously.
Or the artist formerly known as Prince.
Or the artist formerly known as...
The artist formerly
for the
known
artist formerly known as Prince. Isn't that what he is now?
I don't know. For a while, he was just the artist.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah. Stupid. A moron. Yeah. Okay, anyways, let's get into some tech. This first story is quite amazing. And I say that in the most awesome way ever. Mm-hmm. There is a group of people out on the internet called Archive Team. And they have, believe it or not, archived all of GeoCities. So those of you who have made your own web pages in the past, maybe 10 years ago, GeoCities was where you went. And if you remember browsing any GeoCities site, there were animated graphics and scrolling crap and blinking crap, and they were just horrible.
Tiled backgrounds of like shiny objects.
Tiled shiny backgrounds. Basically the worst web pages on the internet. But they are a part of our internet history. And they are something worth saving. So GeoCities was just going to kill them. Like, delete them, get rid of the servers. It's actually Yahoo.
Yeah, they're owned by Yahoo now.
Yeah, so Yahoo was just going to shut down the servers, delete the data, you know, just get rid of it completely. Delete all of our history. So this team, when they heard about that, they're like, no, we're going to archive it. And they got most of it. How big... They're releasing it on BitTorrent. How big is that? I forget the exact number.
I think it was somewhere in, like, the 600... gigabyte region?
Yeah, it was a 652 gigabytes.
Yeah.
Compressed.
Yeah, that's huge.
Over a terabyte if you uncompress it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you want to get back and look at all that old stuff, you can download it. I just hope you have a lot of hard drive space.
Now, I think this is cool just for preservation's sake. You know, we don't have, you know, everything, most printed media that makes of any, like... you know, books, magazines, journals, all that stuff, it gets generally archived in our libraries. And I'm sure libraries do some digital archiving of, like, photos in, like, media, like sounds, things like that, maybe videos.
That would be cool.
You know, they might do some of that. But they don't really, no one's out there, except with the exception of the Web Archive and the Wayback Machine.
Right.
If you ever played
archive.org.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool website, actually. Go there. If you want to have some fun, go there. Search for, like, you know, your company's website, and then look for the year, the earliest year you can.
See what it looked like 10 years ago.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they'll probably have frames.
if you search for kevinslonka.com and search for the very beginnings, there were frames.
Yeah, I mean...
And tiled backgrounds and blinking tags.
Frames aren't so bad if they're done correctly, but, you know. Anyway, it's... The Wayback Machine is probably the only thing out there, Web Archive. And, you know, I don't know that they were archiving all of GeoCities... Or not.
And even if they were, you have to know the site name.
Yeah.
Like the URL. You can't can't just say, I want to look at anything that was on GeoCities.
Right.
So these guys, I don't know how they figured out all of the URLs on GeoCities, but they tried to download them all.
Well, like a lot of the GeoCities stuff, they were in rings too. Remember the whole ring thing?
Like Link Exchange and all that cool stuff. Yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember web rings.
Web rings.
Like there'd be a topic and you'd like join the web ring and you'd have a control at the bottom of your web page that would allow you to go to the next site in the ring and the previous site in the ring.
Whatever happened to web rings?
I don't know. They're actually kind of cool.
Yeah, they make sense.
Well, basically Google came out. And then it was like, I can't remember where that's at. Like, so I'm just going to search for it, and it'll probably find it.
Search engines killed the web ring.
Probably. Good search engines. Good.
Like InfoSeek.
Yeah. Or Metacrawler.
Ooh. Dogpow.
Yeah, Dogpow. AltaVista.
AltaVista.
But yeah, this is really cool. I think we should preserve our online heritage.
What I really hope is that somebody, maybe these people who have enough hard drive space, will download it all, put it on their own web server, and put it back up on the internet for people to browse.
Yeah, it'd be kind of neat. I mean, the traffic might get a little arduous.
That is true. They would have to have some mucho traffic.
I can't believe this cost all that much money for Yahoo to...
Well, that was one of the complaints on their website. They're saying it doesn't cost them any more money. Like, they're not doing anything.
Yeah, it's like, oh, the GeoCities server went down. You know, you spend a couple grand and put another one up. I mean, people couldn't have been hitting it that hard.
Right. Yeah, it's not costing them bandwidth money. They don't have to maintain anything.
I mean, I don't think anyone would have had a problem if they just like stuck a banner ad at the top of every single one of the pages.
Yeah, who cares?
And just made money from it.
Just as long as the pages are still there.
Yeah. So, cool. Kudos to the archive team.
Yes. Awesome archive team. Stupid Yahoo.
Yes.
Moving on. It's a sad day, but only for those people who are getting arrested by the FBI. And I say that because it is the end of the line for LimeWire. So those of us who have used programs in the past to download music, you know, started off with Napster, and then when Napster started getting shut down, everybody moved in their own direction. There was iMesh, there was LimeWire, there was... what were some other ones?
There was one with an M.
M.
It started with an M. I can't think of it right now.
I don't know, but there were a bunch. LimeWire became the most popular, and because of that, the FBI or other government agencies started infiltrating it, uploading songs that looked real but ultimately weren't. So whenever you downloaded them, they arrested you or slapped you with a big lawsuit and you had to pay lots of money. Well, that doesn't matter anymore because LimeWire has been shut down. From their website, they posted that the injunction stated that the searching, downloading, uploading, file trading and or file distribution functionality and or all functionality must be disabled immediately. So basically, that's lawyer speak of saying, just shut it down.
Yeah, I'm a little excited about this, actually, because then my friends won't be installing LimeWire and getting those stupid viruses.
Oh, dude, I hate fixing people's computers who have this on there.
Yeah, it's like, seriously, dude, can't you, like, protect yourself a little bit with some...
Yeah, or spend the 99 cents to get the song legally.
Oh, Nutella? Is that what I'm thinking of?
Nutella was one of them.
Yeah, that's one.
But that's definitely not an M.
No, it's not.
Morpheus?
Morpheus.
Morpheus.
Yeah, now that ran on the same network as LimeWire, right?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember that network, the name of that thing. But
it was so long ago that I even had these... It was so long ago that I had Windows to have these programs. So it was like pre-college days for me, so I don't even know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if you are using LimeWire and you're one of the lucky few who weren't arrested or sued, I guess you can't use it anymore. Go to Amazon MP3. Don't support iTunes in the buying of music. They suck. Amazon MP3. So next story, Ryan, I believe is yours.
So this one's kind of interesting. We've all heard about paywalls. A lot of the...
Like the, what is it, the New York Times?
Or, yeah, I think...
Or is it the Wall Street Journal?
The Wall Street Journal has one.
That's the one.
New York Times has like a limited, like you have to sign up sometimes. It's kind of weird.
That is true, only for some articles.
Yeah, or like if you read for too long. But this, a local newspaper, took it to the next level and...
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. If you read for too long, if you're a slow reader.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the title is the local news website says you need to pay to read its stories, says, it's collecting visitor IPs to sue. So this newspaper is actually, put a warning up, a banner that said, we allow you to read one article for free. This one that you're on. Thereafter, to read more or to return later, a subscription is needed. Please don't abuse the privilege. To subscribe, see the ad to the right. We provide a service to you. We deserve to be paid for it.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. And there's another, they have another posting up. A subscription is required at North, this is the North County, I'm sorry, North Country Gazette. We allow only one free read per visitor. And they go on to talk about collecting IP numbers and persistent intruders who refuse to buy a subscription may have some calls from their attorneys.
They are engaging in the theft of services.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I don't think these people really understand how the internet works.
Right.
If you put it out there, I'm allowed to look at it.
Right. It's period. Free.
Yeah. It's the way it works. And if you can't monetize it through advertising, that pretty much tells me that your site is crap.
Right. Maybe your paper should shut down.
Yeah. And honestly, I don't have a lot of sympathy for local newspapers that aren't able to, adapt. I mean, it's if you can't monetize your content, you know, even yesterday's newspaper, like yesteryear's newspaper, they made most of their money through advertising.
Right.
You know?
And even today's, look at the local newspapers. We have newspapers in our town, one that's named Our Town.
Yeah.
Completely free.
Yeah, it comes in the mail.
By advertising.
Right, comes in the mail. I mean, not only does it come free, they have to pay the postal service for it to be there.
Right.
So I think that if you can't do it, then it's your own problem. But trying to come after me with lawyers is just ridiculous. So
yeah, and gathering IPs and, I mean, this is only going to work for certain things. Because, you know, how proxies work. And that if you're at work or if you're somewhere at a company and you're looking at this website, your IP is going to show up as the proxy's IP. And that means that there could be hundreds, if not thousands, of people who show up as the same IP.
Yeah.
They can't track you down to a per-person basis.
They'd have to go after the ISP or whoever's providing the IP number to get the logs
right.
of the NATed addresses.
Exactly.
Yeah, or subpoena your NATed firewall or something.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that if anybody gets one of these subpoenas, they're just going to laugh.
Yeah, I don't see this as even being close to enforceable. So if you really do like the North Country Gazette's newspaper, I'm sure you could read at your leisure without fear of lawsuit.
Yeah, seriously. Even with all of these warnings, just to ignore them.
Just for everyone's information, I went to the website. I did see the banner on some pages. It seemed like they had locked most of the articles by the point that this had like hit the web and the news mill. And most of the articles you had to type in a password to get to the article. But I went through their little process of trying to get it and actually pay for a subscription. They make it sound easy. It's like, oh, just go over here to the right and click the link. I couldn't find it. I spent probably a half hour looking for it. And well, not that much, but a while. Long enough that I got frustrated and said, I'm putting this article in Slugcast.
So. Yeah, because the warning made it sound like, look over to the right and there is a link.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Whatever. Stupid North Country Gazette. Why is it that all of these companies that we talk about, we think they're stupid? You know, why are people doing stupid things? I mean, come on.
I don't know. I think maybe we're like teaching them a lesson that maybe they can like make more money if they just did it the right way.
Yeah. How dumb are they?
I don't
know. Like, do they not realize they can make real money?
Yeah. We should be selling our advice.
Let's do
maybe
that.
We're dumb.
Ooh. Maybe we're in the Matrix.
Maybe.
But if we are in the Matrix, maybe we'll have some fast internet connections.
That'd be sweet.
And while we're there, we might be using a new type of DSL.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Oh, do you see what I did there?
Yes.
Not the vehicle. oh, you just got that.
Yep.
So vendors are now starting to test a different kind of, a newer kind of DSL, VDSL 2, a new version of that. And they're getting some really awesome speeds. Speeds of around 400 megabits. One company has said it's achieved up to 910 megabits on DSL, your freaking phone cable.
That's gigabit territory.
Yeah, that is almost 1 gigabit. Now, the way they do it, the way this company, Alcatel-Lucent, got the 910 megabits can't be brought to the home because it used more strands of wire than our current phone companies use in our normal telephone service. But right. The 400 megabit speed still only uses the 2 strands of wire. And they do it in a way of a noise cancellation, and they use virtual wires. I mean, it's weird to think about, but they're making a virtual connection on top of your hardwired connection so that they can isolate send and receive, and they can do that double over because you're using virtual connections, and it's crazy. I mean, you really have to read the article here on a PC World's Business Center. And Yeah, so they're saying that anybody can get about the 400 megabits. That's a standard with your normal telephone cable right now. Would you switch to DSL if you could get this right now?
Well, I have DSL.
I'm sorry. Would you continue using DSL?
yes, I would. Actually, I would. I mean, for me, it's all about the fastest thing that I can get for a reasonable price. So
that's the kicker, the reasonable price.
Yeah, I mean, if it, and I don't mind contracts. You know, the first time I got DSL, you sign a year contract. It's
exactly.
It's really not that big a deal.
When I signed up with my WiMAX, it was a 3-year contract. Because the antenna was like $1,000.
Oh, wow.
So in order to not charge me that, they're like, are you going to have this for 3 years? Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind that sort of thing, you know, keeping or a contract to pay it off. But yeah, this is impressive. I think this is exactly what we need because, you know, right now, the only bad thing about this is it seems like cable companies, at least in the rural areas, haven't been moving real fast to like up their bandwidth.
Well, they've got you by the balls in most rural areas. They are the only choice.
Right. Well, I mean, even in like the rural areas that also have DSL. Because, you know, we're in a market where there's competition, but there's not a lot of advancement. Like, we've been stuck at 3 megabit here for probably, with DSL, for about probably 3 years now.
Well, I mean, you think of it even with cable too. Even though cable is offering 8 megabit and burst up to whatever, that's not true.
Yeah.
You're still only getting 3 megabit, really.
Right. Well, I think in Johnstown, I think it's only a burst to 8.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it might be better than the DSL, but it's still not killer fast.
Right. It's not worth the switch.
Right. It's not the 16 megabits and 20 megabits that they're getting on cable in some of the bigger cities.
Right.
And the, you know, 15 to 45 on Fios. So I would like to see other technologies that maybe we could get some more competition.
And I'm wondering, you know, what benefits will they see? Like, why would Verizon want to do this? I mean, in areas like this, the only reason they would do that is if they're going to make money. It's going to be very expensive to implement this, and they have to count on a lot of switchers, you know, a lot of people switching to make money.
Well, I mean, basically, it's a game of, you know, chess. Like, who makes the first move? Well, I don't know if that's really chess, but somebody's going to make the
checkers.
First move. Checkers, yeah. You know that, it's more like mutually assured destruction and thermonuclear war.
Global thermonuclear war.
Yeah, that's really what they're playing. It's like, who makes the first move? You know, and I'm just kidding. But seriously, if Verizon decides to deploy it, you know, then they could potentially steal a lot of customers away from cable, because cable right now does have, you know, on paper, it definitely does have a speed advantage.
Right.
And, you know, for cable, like maybe they would decide to upgrade to DOCSIS 3 and deploy like 30 or 40 megabit.
Now, systems. I don't know this. You might. Would that require new cabling? Because with HD and running over coax, you need the thicker cable with a thicker copper core.
You need an RG6 is what
right,
it is.
Right. Yeah. Is that required for DOCSIS 3 that they would have to run that under the ground to our houses because we have older cable?
I don't think so. And I don't even think that I don't think that's even the way that cable modems work, in the sense that I think the distribution's actually fiber. Well, they're higher bandwidth links.
But to our house?
No, to like local...
Right. I'm talking about from the local building to our house, like that piece of cable. Can that handle DOCSIS 3 speeds?
I still think that's like a multiplexed link that's higher than DOCSIS 2. Like, I don't think it's even cable. I think it's like some other digital fabric that goes from there to like a local community sort of distribution. And then those connections are where there's the cable to, you know... What do you call it? The DOCSIS part of it.
Right.
I think. I'm not sure, but I think that's how it works.
It makes sense to me because I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to bet. I think you're completely correct in this, but I think that nobody's going to make a move because they are going off of the old adage from War Games, the only winning move is not to play. So no,
that's a good one.
Nobody is going to make the first move and up your bandwidth speeds. Speaking of bandwidth speeds, though, this next article about Fios is yours.
This is really cool. Verizon has demonstrated they've done a field trial of their XG-PON2 Which I have no idea.
What does that even mean?
It's their, it's basically their optical network, technology. I think the ON stands for optical network.
I'm going to look it up while you're talking, see if I can figure it out.
Cool. I think the current network for Fios is called GPON, and this is the next generation of it. And this field trial has reached 10 gigabit capabilities to the home. They actually have a video, and I linked this from Engadget. There's a video that Verizon had posted with some of their field technicians. And what they have done is they've taken the XG... Excuse me. Sorry. they've taken their XGPON 2 hardware and brought it to a subscriber site and then used the actual same fiber cable that the existing Fios that customer had was using. So it both,
that is awesome.
Yeah, both transmission or both networks were over the same cable, and they put them side by side. So they had two computers, one connected to the XGPON network, the other one connected to the classic Fios network. And of course, the computer that had the XGPON needed a special card, according to their video, to be able to get these types of download speeds, because most NICs don't even support, a lot of NICs don't even support 1 gigabit.
Right. Yeah, I guess in terms of consumer, it would mean a new router and a new card that does 10 gigabit.
To hit that type of speed.
Right.
But they basically just did a file transfer over the network, and it was very impressive. A movie that would take about, I can't remember the times, but you know, it was several fold faster.
Well, it says here that 2.3 gigabyte movie in 4 seconds.
There you go. Yeah, that's just
4 seconds.
Yeah, that's half a DVD in 4 seconds.
Wow. And by the way, it's a gigabit passive optical network GPON.
Okay.
So I guess that's extra gigabit passive optical network.
Two.
Whatever. But that's still awesome. I wish it would be more awesome. I wish we had Fios around here. But for those of you with Fios, you know, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, you might actually get to use this.
Yeah, this is... it just shows that it's nice that their technology scales.
Right.
They won't need to run new cables.
Yeah, and that is the cool thing with fiber is that, you know, it's just light. You're not going to get more light that's going to melt the cable, where with coax, you know, you start pumping electricity across that and you're going to melt the core.
Right.
So that is cool with fiber.
I think the other thing about this right now is 10 gigabit is fast enough that I don't think we'll have to worry. I don't want to be like a Bill Gates here and say 640K is all anyone should ever need, but a lot of computers can't even sustain data rates like this internal to the computer.
Right. Across the buses.
Right. You know, to the hard drive, from the hard drive, that sort of stuff. So it's impressive.
It is very impressive. So let's assume that this comes out. Current Fios is what? Do you know
prices?
Yeah.
I think the basic Fios, which is like, I think a 5.1, 5 megabit down, 1 megabit up, is the same price as their DSL.
Okay, so that's crappy. Do you know the prices of like the 30 megabits?
Those are probably in this. I think those are
60 to 70
region, and then they have a 45 megabit package that's like in the 120, 140 region.
Okay, so that is pretty high. So this comes out, those prices will probably go down, but this one will probably be 120. It'll probably take over the top price.
Yeah, and it's not to say that they would unleash 10 gigabit the first day.
Right. Yeah. Of course,
you know,
they
would. It might be like, you know, a couple hundred megabit to start.
It would definitely be a couple fold above what they have now.
Yeah.
But assuming they come out with a new service that takes over the top price, would you switch? Would you pay that much to have this kind of speed?
I probably wouldn't pay for anything more than 100 megabits or so, because my routers and my current, you know, network in my house isn't going to support anything higher than that.
That is true.
And you're really limited by your wireless. That's probably the most limiting factor. While, you know, they tout 300 megabit speeds from 802.11n networks, your real world throughput's much less.
Yeah, that's in a perfect, unobstructed line of sight.
You're probably looking in for real world throughput, 80-ish megabit.
Right, which is awesome.
It's good.
For wireless.
Oh, yeah, it's great. But you'd be silly to pay for anything above that for download speeds, unless you had a lot of clients sharing that connection.
Right. Yeah, I think you're totally right, because like you said before, there's no hardware change. So you buy the lower speed, and eventually your router breaks, you buy one that can handle 10 gigabit, and now you can upgrade your internet. You know, just pay the increase. You don't have to buy new hardware, and now you have faster speed.
Yeah. Now, for to go from regular GPON to this XGPON, they'll probably have to come out and put a new transceiver on your house. But still, not too bad.
I forgot about that whole they need to put a box on the side of your house to get Fios.
Because I think with Fios, what comes into your house is actually Ethernet. Like, outside of the box is fiber.
Right.
And then into your house is just an Ethernet cable.
I do believe that's how it works.
Yeah. So
I want Fios so bad.
Me too.
So bad.
Me too.
So anyways, let's get away from internet connections. And we never really talk about, you know, audiovisual style stuff, but there is a really awesome article that I just found this week on Hot Hardware. And believe it or not, it is real, out in the world right now, that you can buy usable wireless HDMI. This, I want this. Like, this will be awesome. There are two companies, Asus and, who's the other company? Brightview. Both have WHDI wireless transmitters out. And, I mean, this basically makes it, there's no configuration. There's a little box, you know, for the transceiver, and there's a little box for the receiver. You just plug them into your source and destination, and bam.
Bam.
They did a demo video. It's 12 minutes long, so I'm not going to play any part of it on the show. But, I mean, it was perfect. Like, no frame skipping, less than a millisecond latency. You just plug it in, there is no configuration, and it goes. The only trouble is that you have a 30-foot range, so you're not going to be streaming from your bedroom into, you know, from something in your living room. Not going to happen.
Right.
But I might actually go see if I can find a set of these and try to use them.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I've actually had a few times. My laptop has a Blu-ray player in it, and there's a couple times where I wanted to watch a Blu-ray before I had a Blu-ray player
plugged into your TV.
Yeah. And these would have come in handy. And I could see this, you know, maybe even in the future, like a lot of hotels now have flat screen TVs.
I didn't even think of that.
So if you're on travel, you want to watch a Blu-ray, pop it in your laptop, you know.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing, you know, with me, I'm very picky when it comes to watching movies. Like, I won't watch ripped movies because they've been compressed. I won't watch anything on my laptop screen because it's too small. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to watch a movie, it's going to be a real 1080p Blu-ray, and it's going to be on my TV because I just can't stand anything else. So this would be awesome to have that ability from your laptop. If you have something on your laptop, just plug in the transceiver, set it on the coffee table, and bam.
Yep.
Yeah, and that hotel thing, that's actually a really good idea.
Yeah.
They'd have to worry about people walking away with the transceivers if they just left them in the hotel room for you to use and plug in.
Oh, yeah, but, I mean, this thing looks small enough that you could take it with you.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like palm size, fit in the palm of your hand. So, yeah, if you're looking for this, if you have trouble, you know, with cabling, go out and look for Asus and Brightview. They both have their WHDI wireless transmitters. They are very good, full 1080p. So, unfortunately, that's all the audio-visual stuff we have for this week. I got to start looking for more articles like that, because I like talking about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're going to get a little scary. We always have a security section, and this first one is kind of a doozy, or it could have been a bigger doozy, and that is a computer failure. It was originally thought to be a power failure, but it was a computer failure at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. Took down 50 ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. Basically, if Russia attacked us, we couldn't fight back because 50 of our missiles were down for I don't know how long. How long did it say?
It says about an hour, I think.
Okay, so yeah.
It's about 1/9 of our nuclear arsenal.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It wouldn't completely have, you know, blocked us from a retaliation attack or anything like that. They said that the other missiles will actually pick up the slack, but that makes the targeting more complex.
Yeah, the article goes over the LCC, the Launch Control Center computer. Those would have to be, you know, programmed to pick up the slack and repoint at targets of interest.
Yeah.
But still, 50 missiles out of commission.
Yeah, this is pretty crazy. You know, at first they thought it was a power failure. Later they found out that it was an engineering failure.
Yeah, it was like a ping response.
Yeah.
This LCC sends out they're not pings, but they're like ping requests to make sure that all the missiles are online. Mm-hmm. And if one of them doesn't respond, the thing, this one, like, freaked out and just took out all the ones that it was controlling.
Yeah.
It just said, okay, you're all offline.
Yeah, they actually said that the missiles, if the missiles themselves detect an error on the network, they start to return error codes, and then it's sort of like cascade fail. There's all this, like, traffic and...
Yeah, cascading fail. Who programmed that?
I don't know.
Punch him in the throat.
Yeah. But I guess they ended up taking that one machine offline and brought the system back up, and it works, and that current, the one computer that was having problems, they left it offline.
Yeah, so that was what, you know, was kind of weird to me is, you know, there are multiple computers in the LCC, and I would assume, you know, just the way of things that I've worked on, if you have multiple computers do the same thing, they all run the same version, you know, you patch them all the same, you make sure they're all the same. Why did this one die?
It was probably a hardware failure, I would imagine, or
yeah, you know. They mentioned that in the past when this happened, it was a hardware failure. I don't recall the article saying that it was specifically a hardware failure, but whatever it was, I just thought it was weird that one computer, you know, did all of this.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Who programmed that?
A little scary.
Yeah, so we're back up now. No need to worry. You know, this was a while ago, back on October 26th, so, and they were only down for an hour, so don't worry. You know, if Russia attacks or Cuba attacks, we're good. Good to go. So last week we talked about an extension for Firefox called Fire Sheep that lets you steal people's cookies and log in as them. And Ryan, you brought up an article this week going into a little more detail.
Yeah, actually, an article on Computer World. They talked about the ways to protect against Fire Sheep, and as we mentioned in the last show, and Kevin mentioned, HTTPS is one of the most foolproof ways to protect, but that requires websites to switch over, you know, their whole website to HTTPS. And some other methods that this article brings up is using a VPN service, which I didn't really even know these existed. This is actually sort of news to me. I know, like, most people's employers, hospitals, governments, all that sort of stuff, provide, you know, VPN services for their remote employees or when you're working from home. And if you're familiar with VPN, it's, you know, basically it starts a virtual network between the two computers, and it uses a protocol called PPTP, it's point-to-point tunneling protocol, to make a secure connection through the internet that is encrypted. That's encrypted, yes. And that's pretty cool. So if you want to do this as a home user, you know, there's really no way to do that unless you, like, set up your own...
Right. Unless you're a Linux geek and you install VPN server on your home machine and configure it and everything.
Right, but then, you know, you have to have a machine dedicated to be, like, kind of like as a VPN.
Your IP address always changes.
Yeah, so there's downsides to this, but there's a company called StrongVPN that for $7 a month or $55 a year provides a VPN service for anyone, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is awesome.
There's another one called Trust Connect. I guess it's pretty similar. And that one's about $50 annually. So this is one way to protect against these type of attacks. This, the minute you'd get on, and how you'd use this is the minute you're on a public Wi-Fi that's an open, some, you know, somewhere like at a Starbucks or wherever, you log into your Trust Connect or Strong VPN connection, and that encrypts all the traffic over your Wi-Fi connection the whole way into their servers. Now at that point, your traffic is again unencrypted and back on the internet, but it's now somewhere far away that is much less likely to get in, have an intruder break in.
Right, and that's the point. Like this article mentioned, you know, like you said, that, oh, there's still a point when your data is unencrypted, and the guy's like, yeah, but it's not unencrypted over the wireless anymore, so you're safe.
Yeah, it protects against the Fire Sheep attack.
Right.
There's other ways that could, you know, people could hack in, but it'd be unlikely. So you can check those out. And then the other thing they mentioned, and I'm not sure if we had the name of it last time, is the HTTPS Everywhere.
That's, had that name, but the next one we didn't.
What's that? Oh, Force TLS?
Yeah, I actually didn't even know of this extension.
Yeah.
They work differently. HTTPS Everywhere is kind of like an in-browser extension that finds traffic and switches the HTTP to HTTPS. But Force TLS is actually a header that gets sent in your TCP traffic, or sorry, your HTTP traffic. And it's a normal header, but most websites don't use it or don't support it. So this extension will actually modify your header so that you request SSL from a web server, and if the web server gets that request and supports it, it'll switch for you.
Oh.
So they both, HTTPS Everywhere and Force TLS, kind of achieve the same thing, just in different ways.
That's cool. Yeah, I didn't read into it in that much detail to understand, but so that's pretty cool. I think these are a couple decent options.
Right, it's something everybody needs to know about.
Yeah, I mean, until they, you know, more sites start offering HTTPS, which hopefully they will, and you won't have to use some third-party tool.
And this is why everybody should use Gmail, because Gmail is the only public email service that forces you to use HTTPS.
So it's definitely a good thing. Hopefully, you know, maybe we'll see some movement on a modification to the way websites just even use cookies. Like, maybe we might not get HTTPS everywhere, but maybe we'll get some other technology that doesn't put a like an unencrypted file on your computer.
Yeah,
maybe
cookies are old. You know? Yeah. They're an old technology.
Hopefully there'll be some way to protect against this. So,
yeah, and one thing that I just want to point out that not too many people know about, you know, you go to a website, you see in the address bar it says HTTPS, you think you're encrypted, but if you look at the actual lock icon or whatever icon your browser gives you, if it has like a slash through it, or in Internet Explorer, if you get one of those messages that, you know, some parts of this page are unencrypted, do you still want to use it? You hit OK. It still says HTTPS. But if you ever have that lock with a slash through it, your entire session is unencrypted. Even though it says HTTPS, once that lock gets the slash through, or you get that IE message saying that parts of the page are unencrypted, that really means all of the page is unencrypted. So if you get that, you know, hit refresh, try to make HTTPS work, or just don't use the site. Like, you can't always trust that lock just because you have the lock, you think it's working.
Right.
So yeah, this is actually awesome. I didn't get a chance yet. I need to get to, I'm probably going to get a Starbucks, or maybe McDonald's, because I think McDonald's is free Wi-Fi, whereas Starbucks you have to pay now.
Yeah.
At least in our Starbucks you do. So I might just hop over to McDonald's with my Mac and just sit there and see how many things pop up.
Yeah, be interesting.
Yeah. I was thinking, here was my idea for this. Take my business cards with me, print out a nice little sheet or half sheet of paper that details, you know, it says something like, you know, you're using a social network, HTTP, you know, with a nice little picture with an arrow pointing here, you know, just something to show them. So whenever I would walk over to somebody, you know, I would see their name pop up in my Fire Sheep list with their profile picture. So I would see who they are. I could walk over to them, be like, hey, you're browsing unencrypted. Here's my card. Here's how you can fix it on this sheet of paper. If you have any more questions, stop doing it. You know, just kind of a way to help people out.
Yeah, it might spook them out.
I think it would definitely spook them out. They would probably leave.
Or maybe like call the police.
Maybe I won't do this. I'm really just trying to help people, but whatever. So our last security article of the day is something that is all hardcore Linux people knew that could happen. But most people who just, you know, are casual Linux users or new Linux users probably thought that, oh, I'm using Linux, I can't get viruses, I can't get infected with anything. But those of us who know anything about anything realized that one day it was going to happen. And that day was October 28th when this article came out. You probably heard about the Kubeface virus. That came out a while ago and spread across Windows machines. You know, makes a botnet and spreads itself. But now, a new variant of the Kubeface worm can install itself on Linux machines.
Dum dum dum.
Yeah. Dun dun da. It's kind of scary. But the good thing about Linux machines is that they haven't found a way to exactly hook in to the kernel and make it so every time you boot it starts. So as soon as you reboot, it's gone. So. Yeah, it's still more secure, but the counterpoint to that the article points out is that most people who use Linux never reboot their machines. Like, that's one of the reasons you use Linux, because it's stable, you never have to reboot for anything. So if somebody does get infected with this, it's going to be up for just as long as a Windows machine.
Yeah.
So do you use Linux at all on anything?
Oh, boy, no. It's been a long time since I've had a Linux machine in my house.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, you know, I've been tempted to, you know, try out Ubuntu on...
Stab in the heart.
Why? You don't like Ubuntu?
Oh, kindergarten Linux.
That's
Linux for Windows users.
I mean, I basically would like to try it just for the sake of saying, oh, yeah, I've tried Ubuntu, you know, because I haven't even, like, looked at it, honestly.
Right.
But I was always back in the day, I was a Mandrake fan.
That was really old. Yeah. That was back in the day. That's what I started on.
Yeah, and that... Mandrake was like, I mean, I first started on Red Hat. I was like Red Hat version 5 probably is when I started.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I did, Mandrake got up to like version 9 or 10, and that's when Corel, I think, bought them.
Yeah, there was a point, I stopped using it by then, that they made a change. It was like Mandriva now or something.
Mandriva maybe was a spinoff. That's when they split into like, just like Red Hat and Fedora did.
Okay.
But it was still Mandrake. It was like 9 or 10, I think, is when I last left off. And this probably had been like 2001, 2002, yeah. 2003, somewhere in there. And it's just, I don't know. Back then, the window manager in GNOME was still terrible. In my opinion.
No, back then, you are completely right. Everything about Linux, is if you were a graphical user, sucked.
Yeah,
everything.
It was still pretty rough. And there was just other things about it, like that. And I was a gamer, and back then games didn't support
Linux.
And
that still sucks.
Yeah, I know there's some that come out with Linux variants, but they're rare. But I should probably try a few out.
Yeah, I actually tweeted today, Fedora version 14 was just released.
And, which Red Hat kernel is that?
It's the newer one. Like, Fedora is the testing ground for Red Hat Enterprise.
Right, but I mean, so is like Fedora 14, does that translate to Red Hat version 5? Like, is it actually nine
versions?
No,
the numbers don't correlate like that.
Up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so Red Hat Enterprise is out with version 5 now, so the things that you see in Fedora 12, 13, 14, 15 will be eventually tested, vetted, and rolled into Red Hat Enterprise 6.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it just came out, and it's actually awesome. I tweeted out that, you know, anybody unhappy with Windows should give it a try, because I believe that it has come a long way, and any normal Windows user can now use it. Like, it's really that easy now. It comes with normal applications. You can get to the internet. You can get to email. You can play your music. Like, it's just easy now. And, of course, I always recommend Fedora in lieu of any other Linux distribution, just for the fact that if you work in an enterprise situation, enterprises use Red Hat. Fedora is Red Hat for all intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. So if you learn Fedora, you inherently know Red Hat.
Right.
So it's helpful that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would definitely say give Fedora a try.
Do they still have those names for the kernel? Like back when I...
Oh, yeah.
Like back when I was using it, I think it was Zoot.
Red Hat. There's 5. Zoot, and then there was like, Sapphire and... I think
6 might have been Sapphire.
Yeah, they have new names and everything.
Yeah, I still do that.
Yeah, and they actually run a contest every time that anybody can submit. They have a convention of, like, it fits into a sentence, and you have to compare the new name with the previous name and fit it into a sentence, and then if that was one of the good ones, they pick it and use it.
Yeah.
But, Ubuntu does the same thing with their, like, I don't know, Laughing Lenny, or I don't know.
Yeah.
They're doing the alphabet, so they're up to like, what, I now? Maybe H-I-J. They might be up to J. Whatever.
Interesting. Yeah. There were so many flavors back then, but...
There still are. Ubuntu kind of came out, and, you know, they got popular because, like I said, they're the kindergarten Linux. They're the ones that make it easier to transfer from Windows to Linux because everything looks the same.
Yeah.
But I still don't recommend it. I don't like it. So anyways, we always have some social networking stories, and this week is no different from any other week. The first two stories, I'm going to start off with a, really? Does anybody care? The first one, coming from Digital Trends, MySpace was accused of leaking user information to advertisers. So question number one, does anybody use MySpace? Really? Do you?
No.
I don't.
I actually still have an account.
I wiped mine a year ago, probably exactly a year ago.
I just, I don't have a need to be on more than one, like, social network, so I think Facebook kind of crushed them and
yeah, they're done.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, they claim that they have their holdovers. The music place now.
Yeah. That's
but still, you don't need an account to view music on there or listen to music, because most artists that have pages on there, their pages are public because they want exposure. So yeah,
I think they could. If you look outside of MySpace, and of course now you have, and you look at other places for like that musicians can have websites. They can make their own websites, but it's like sometimes being in a market is a little bit better because your product gets more publicity that way. Like,
right.
If you're just out on the web, basically, if for someone to find you, you either have to know it or like Google just has to happen to like give you an ad for it.
Yeah, MySpace is a central location.
Right. So if they look, if it's something that they maybe could turn into a revenue model. If you look, iTunes is already trying to do that. They have what's called Ping.
Well, Ping is slowly failing. It's going to go away soon.
Yeah, I don't know what'll happen. I heard Ping was supposed to be integrated with Facebook and that all the talks fell apart.
Oh, yeah,
that.
Facebook shut it down.
Yeah, but so MySpace may have a place in the market for, you know, for musicians. And if they do a good job, I think that, like, my advice to them would be to link up with the Music Genome Project. And,
definitely Pandora.
Yeah, or something. And that would help them, like, provide music, provide websites, like help people find new artists from a given artist and that sort of stuff with the
music. Here's my thing with music. There are too many sites doing it. There's MySpace, there's iMeme, there's Last.fm, there's Pandora. Mm-hmm. There are so many sites that all do the same thing. They let you find music, they let you rate music, they let you share music.
Yeah, but see, the thing about Pandora is they don't have like artist web pages. And that I think maybe what we need is really like a one-stop shop for, you know, music.
That would be awesome if there was one of those. And maybe that's what MySpace is doing, like you said, because our next article from the UK's Telegraph, MySpace just went under a major site redesign. And people are claiming that it's their last-ditch effort to retain their social music crown.
Mm-hmm.
So they changed their logo, which I think is stupid now. Their logo is the word my with a big underscore after it to symbolize the space. So MySpace. I think that's stupid. But have you checked out the new MySpace redesign?
I have not. I probably should. I mean, just to say like, oh, it sucks or not. But
from the images in this article, yeah, it still sucks. I mean, I'll give them this. It looks nicer than it did before. They definitely made it look nicer, but I don't know. You know, like I said before, I still think there's way too many music sites and I just don't use that one. I never have. So I don't really think that... I don't know. I shouldn't say that I don't think that they're going to be profitable and they're going to stay around for a long time because, you know, like this article points out, they still have the 13 to 35-year-olds is the demographic that they're going for, and those people still use it. I don't know. Yeah. I don't use it. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, I could see something like this, if it's done right, it could potentially, you know, take down a couple different things on the web. Like all it really takes for the musicians out there to or for the music industry to change even further than it has is for the musicians to realize that rather than signing away the rights to their material, that they could work more collaboratively with producers and writers and sell their music online in MP3 format.
Yeah, musicians get screwed out of so much money nowadays. Yeah.
I mean, if MySpace did that, if they just provided hosting for music in a central location where you could go and you could download the music, pay for it and download it.
Right.
And gave each artist their own web page, you know, with like maybe with like permanent links so that you can always find it, you know, that's like sort of thing. And
right.
And they could crush iTunes. Like, why would anyone... Because iTunes, to be quite honest, iTunes is... the iTunes Music Store, I should be more specific. The iTunes Music Store is, in my opinion, kind of crappy.
I agree it is crap, but it will always remain in a top spot just because it's integrated with the iTunes Music Player, which you need if you have an iPod or iPhone device for music. You know, it's all in the same place.
You do for the iPhone, I agree. But if you have an iPod, a lot of people have like hacked them and just run their own firmware.
I agree, but... not the 90% of people out there using them.
No.
You know?
But...
so iTunes Store has that integration, you know, on their side.
So, but anyway.
I hope you're right. I hope they do come and crush all the other music sites and we have one.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Or at least a couple, like just a couple good ones.
Just a couple, not 20 like we have now.
Yeah.
LimeWire. So moving on from MySpace to Facebook, we have a couple things we want to talk about Facebook. Have you seen the new friendship links on Facebook?
Yeah, they see my friendship or see this friendship.
So now, as the article from PC Pro points out, anytime, excuse me, anytime you see in your newsfeed that somebody makes a wall post, one of your friends makes a wall post on another friend's site, that's usually denoted by a name, an arrow, and the name, and then the wall post. Now there is a new link. Instead of just comment and like, now there is comment, like, and see friendship. And when you click see friendship, that will bring up a new page that will show you everything that Facebook has on these two people correlated together in one easy-to-view interface. Every picture that both people are both tagged in, every wall post from either to the other, every event they both attended, comments, wall post, likes, every piece of information Facebook has on these two people, you get to see in one nice-to-stock interface.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I noticed this the other day. I saw the link, and I clicked on it, and it popped up this, like, association between the person and the other person's wall, and I actually wrote on somebody's wall, and I saw that pop up. It was just really weird. And then I asked my brother, I'm like, dude, what's this see friendship thing about? And he's like, oh, it's kind of like wall to wall, but you know, now with more stuff. And I was like, this is a little weird. And I was like, how do I turn it off? And I couldn't.
Yeah, you can't.
I couldn't find it, at least. But apparently the article says that you can't.
Yeah, and here's what makes it weirder. You know, this would be different if you could see your friendship with your friends. You know, pick a friend and see everything that you've communicated with that friend. But you can do this with two other people.
Yeah.
You can just pick any
mutual
two
friends.
You could just pick any two of your friends, type in their names, and see stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a stalker's dream.
Yep.
And of course, as with everything that Facebook does, it's opt out, not opt in. So everybody gets it by default. Actually, it's not even opt out because you can't opt out.
You can't. It's opt in by default right now, and you can't opt out.
It's permanent. Yeah.
We'll see.
Really, Facebook? Really? And in addition to really, Facebook bought the content sharing, or I should say bought most of, you know, enough of the stock that they own it. Dropio, drop.io. Dropio was basically a site that lets people go there, drop some files in a nice little place, give you a URL, and you can share it with your friends, and they can just go download the files. It's just a quick file sharing site. Facebook bought them, shut them down.
Why?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. On Dropio's site, they have up a little thing now, you know, we're done. Sorry, Facebook bought us and we are shut down now. So all of the stuff, that they're not taking any new drops. Nobody can add files to it anymore. You can access the files until the end of the year, at which point everything gets deleted.
Wow.
It's just over.
It's really weird. I mean, were they competing in some way? Or?
Well, here's the thing. Facebook doesn't have anything to compete with that. So I'm thinking they bought them, they shut them down, and they're going to use their code in Facebook file sharing service. I think that's going to be the next thing they add to Facebook.
That's a little weird.
Yeah, but seriously. I don't know how many employees this company had, but they're all probably out of a job now.
Yeah, or assimilated into the Borg.
Ooh, assimilated. Although, you know, Facebook is a good company to work for, so I've heard. You know, they're luring high people from Google, from every other company in Silicon Valley, they all want to go there. The creator of Google Wave quit Google and now works at Facebook.
Oh, right. Wow.
So that's, yeah, I mean, it must be a really good place to work. So I added two more things after the fact because I thought they went in with this talking about Facebook thing. The first one you probably saw. Now, anytime you log into Facebook, you get a page before you can even get to your Facebook page that says, please name the machine you are logging in from. Have you seen that yet?
No, I have not.
Log out of Facebook and then...
Oh, log out, then log back
completely
in.
Completely log out, yeah. Get rid of your cookie and then log back in. So now Facebook is tracking the machines that you log in from. And I should say it might not be pushed out to your account yet because, you know, they do those rolling pushouts and you might not have it. But there is now a setting in your account settings to have Facebook notify you anytime your account is logged in from any machine. So now when you log in, it asks you, name this machine. You put in a name like home laptop, hit continue, and then Facebook sends you a text message, have to have your phone, you know, registered, and it's and an email and says, a new device named this logged in from this IP address at this approximate location. If this is you, ignore it. If this is not you, click this link and we're going to figure this thing out.
Yeah, it didn't happen to me.
Didn't happen to you? Yeah, mm-hmm. So hopefully sometime in the next week you'll get that option. But
weirdly enough, I logged in with an old password by accident and it still let me log in. And it said, well, it says, you logged in with an old password. Do you remember this?
What?
Yeah. So they must be archiving the old passwords.
Which is horrible. Yeah. Really? Saving passwords like that?
Well, I mean, they're probably just saving the hash.
But still.
And then it was like, do you remember your new password? Or, well, first it's like, do you remember making this change? And it gives you the date that it happened on. And I was like, yeah, I do recall that. Because it was like several months ago.
Right.
And I was like, then I logged in. Or then I was like, do you remember your new one? I'm like, yeah. And then it let me log in with my new password. That was weird.
Yeah, that is kind of weird.
I didn't think, whatever.
Yeah, so what do you think about this new machine naming feature?
My guess is it's just an anti-fraud measure.
Oh, I totally agree.
Yeah, I think it's good. It's, if it increases security, I'm happy with it.
Right. The only thing that I don't like so far is that it can't seem to remember that I've logged in from certain machines. While I was at school the other day, I logged in a couple times to test this out, and every time it asked me, you know, name this machine. It didn't remember that I'm logging in from the same machine. Mm. So if it's going to do that every time I log in, I'm going to be pretty mad.
Yeah.
But I do think it's cool because if you're, you know, out at the bar and you get a text message from Facebook that says your Facebook account was logged in from home laptop and you don't have your home laptop with you, you know something's up.
Yeah.
So that is definitely cool.
The cool thing is it might even be like an anti-theft thing. Like somebody stole your laptop, they're using it to log in. Maybe you could like say, oh, it was last used at this IP address, which according to Skyhook says it's at this address.
Yeah, I don't know how. It does say IP and location.
That'd be pretty cool.
I don't know how. Oh, this location is based on information from your ISP or wireless provider. So, and it got, you know, Johnstown, Pennsylvania and my IP address. So it was close.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
cool.
It's not GPS coordinates, but it was close. So plus one for Facebook, you know, even though we just had a bunch of minus ones. But the second and last thing that I added in after the fact was an email that I just got today, I think. Google Buzz was involved in a class action lawsuit.
Yeah, I saw they settled it.
Yes, that was the email. You probably got the email.
Yeah, I did, actually.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about this time.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, so there was a class action lawsuit because a bunch of people sued them saying that Google Buzz, by default, gave out private information that people did not want given out. And now Google has settled it, and they give you a website to go to. And tell me what you think about the settlement. So nobody gets money. Basically, what Google is doing is they are putting $8.5 million into an independent fund, most of which will support organizations promoting privacy education and policy on the web. So what do you think of that?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes these class actions can get a little like skeezy anyways. I'd rather see people get educated than a couple people get rich from a mistake, you know?
I totally agree.
Like, especially one, a very benign mistake.
Yeah, we talked about this before. Neither of us think that it was on purpose that they did this, but a couple people got mad and actually sued them. And the thing is, though, that the webpage that Google gives you says you're involved. Like, everybody with a Gmail account is named in this class action lawsuit. You are a part of suing Google.
Well, you have...
You can opt out.
Yeah, you can opt out.
But if you do nothing, you are in the lawsuit.
Right.
And so if you have a Gmail account, go to buzzclassaction.com and it will give you all the information, you know, tell you what happens if you choose to be in it, what happens if you do nothing, you know, it gives you all of your choices. You don't get any money out of it, so it doesn't matter anyways.
Well, if you want to exclude yourself and sue them on your own, you're welcome to, but you have to get the email in there by December 6, 2010.
Right, and they give you the option to show up in court. So you can say, I want to show up and present my findings or whatever.
Right.
But I'm guessing that's going to be a California court. It doesn't say. Yeah. But I would assume so.
And the judge will probably have stock in Google.
That's true.
Yeah.
And probably be high on medical marijuana, so whatever. Oh, no, Prop 19 didn't pass.
Oh, sorry. Boo-hoo-hoo, you Californians.
So, moving on. We have a couple mobile device stories. The first one, I'm actually very pumped about. BlackBerry. I think we mentioned this before. BlackBerry is coming out with an iPad competitor.
The Playbook.
The Playbook.
Yes.
Have you seen this video or any videos demoing the Playbook?
I've only seen like the original one where they first launched it, and I think the CEO just like had it on stage. And
okay, well, yeah, this,
nothing, no like using it videos.
Yeah, that's pretty much what this is from the Adobe Max conference. But watching them use this, it seems awesome.
Mm-hmm.
They don't name a price for it, but if this comes out and it is $300 or less, I will buy it right now.
Yeah.
I mean, right now.
Yeah, it's got some cool features. Like, it's got the front-facing camera. It's really slick looking. I think they could, if they price it right, they could destroy iPad sales.
Yeah. The entire platform, well, I should say, is it Android apps run on this or something?
Oh, really?
I don't want to say that. There's some platform. Oh, Adobe Air.
Yeah. Oh, that's what, yeah.
Yeah. This whole system runs on Adobe Air, so any Adobe Air app will just work on here. It might not look right, but yeah, it'll work. So anybody who can program in Adobe Air, you can get an application on this device.
Mm-hmm.
And they said even like the base apps are Adobe Air, so they can be extended, they can be used.
That's cool.
I mean, the demo, definitely go to YouTube and look up the BlackBerry Playbook demo highlights and watch the video. It's yeah, awesome.
I think if they price this thing in the $300 range, like, you know, sub three, like $299,
yes,
would be like insane.
I mean, I wouldn't even think about it.
Right.
I would just show up to wherever, like, it's being sold and buy it.
They could actually like basically melt iPad sales. I think they would crush if they got the right price.
Yeah.
Especially with the like the front-facing camera is one of the big features the iPad's missing.
Right. And with a screen this big, you know, I believe this is 7 inches. So bigger than a phone. And if you had a front-facing camera, you could do better Skype,
mm-hmm,
you know, better video calling because you have a bigger screen to see the person on.
Yeah.
So that would be killer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, come on, BlackBerry. Price it right and get it out to the public. I really, really want this. So this next article is talking about cell networks. And I believe we mentioned this last week. We just didn't have the article in front of us to know the specifics. But we always said, anytime we talked about, you know, cell carriers and 3G, 4G, you know, we always said that LTE is 4G. We consider that a fourth generation network. It's going to be the new one. It's going to be faster. Well, apparently we were wrong, because the International Telecommunication Union, the ITU, they're the people who determine, you know, what broadband is classified as 3G, what broadband is classified as second generation, fourth generation. They say that fourth generation 4G is not WiMAX or LTE. It's too slow. So,
Setting the bar here at 100 megabits downstream, which I find
crazy.
It's a little high. I mean, for a portable wide area wireless technology, that's pretty high still. And they also say that typically WiMAX and LTE are operating between 3 and 12 megabits, but I thought LTE was more on the towards 50, I thought.
Yeah, I'm not sure. They mentioned LTE Advanced.
Yeah.
So maybe the newer version of LTE, you know, the current version isn't even out yet.
Yeah.
So maybe some higher version of LTE can hit those speeds.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. I mean, well, I remember a long time ago when they were doing some of the first demos, like one of the first things that that I think it was Samsung demonstrated an LTE device probably about a year ago that could do a live streaming video and do a handoff between 3G back to 4G back to 3G.
That would be awesome.
With seamless video, so it, you know, which is pretty cool. I remember them saying that was somewhere in the order of like 50 megabit, but who knows? It might have been some kind of like engineering test system, and it was, you know, ideal conditions.
Yeah, so this is going to take a long time for me to not say 4G now when talking about LTE.
So are they going to call it 3.5G? Is that what they're going to do? I mean, how are they going to? How is this going to change the marketing?
I don't. Well, this article, in one point, you know, shows that the Sprint Evo, even though they call it the Evo 4G, is not 4G. Yeah. Obviously, you know, this article makes that clear. So Sprint is just tricking you with their marketing, calling that 4G, because now we know that even the newest generation of cell towers that are coming out this year and next year will not even be 4G.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like you said before, you know, with Verizon's EVDO, and then they have the higher version that gets a little faster, and AT&T's 3G, and they have a newer version, you know, HSPA Plus, that's a little faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't change the marketing for that. It's still all 3G, third generation stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe this is just going to still be 3G.
Who knows?
I don't know. But I do want LTE.
Yep.
I want that right now.
Yep.
So our last article of the day. This is a controversial one for iPhone owners. Apple is going to offer a SIM-less iPhone in Europe. What do you think of that?
I'm skeptical of this. One of the powerful, like, features, in my opinion, of GSM phones in general is the whole SIM-based identity, that you can pull the SIM out of one phone, put another phone, and it works. And it works on any network that, you know.
Right,
you can
no take, problems.
Yeah, you can take your phone with you on different networks. I think this is another Apple control thing. They want specific control over which networks their phone runs on. And if let's say whatever the jailbreaking does interferes with this SIM-less part, like with the virtual SIM card in there, then it might render your phone completely useless on any other network except AT&T's.
Or just completely useless. That could break your phone.
It could, like, brick it. Yeah, that would be really bad. But I don't like this. I think we have standards for a reason, and I don't like when people start to deviate from them in such an egregious way.
Right. Yeah. The article does say that, you know, the integrated SIM, it's not going to be like a real card. It's just going to be a part of ROM that has the code, can be used on any wireless carrier who partners with Apple, which in Europe happens to be a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know,
but
so,
not here.
Right. So, honestly, as far as Europe is concerned, I think this might be a good thing. Because now, if you have an iPhone, you can go from O2 to Orange to Verizon to anybody else over there without swapping SIMs. You can just switch, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, what's so bad about swapping a SIM?
Yeah, I haven't had a problem with it. But, yeah, I don't know. If they did this in the U.S., I think it would be exactly what you're saying. Way too controlling, because we only have one network.
I guess they're willing to let people switch, but I still think this is about Apple controlling which carriers are allowed to use that phone at all.
Oh, definitely. If they have a non-removable part that they can program like that, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. You know, this hasn't come out yet. It's just really a rumor. But so is the Verizon iPhone and the iPhone 5 or whatever they're going to call it. So we'll see next year, next July. That's when I assume they're going to come out with it. So any other things you saw this week that you want to bring up?
No, it's been a slow one.
Yeah, it kind of has been a slow one. That's why I threw in those two emails that I got from Facebook and Google.
Actually, one thing is kind of interesting. I did get the chance to check out the MacBook Air.
Oh, you had a hands-on with that.
Yeah, I was out at a Best Buy, and they had the 11-inch and the 13-inch version. I have to say, very impressed with the hardware. It's especially the 11-inch one. I mean, the 13-inch one isn't a whole lot different in terms of, you know, its lightness, or maybe a little bit lighter or smaller, but the 11-inch one is probably the smallest looking full-featured computer I've ever used. Like,
right, and that's the key, full-featured.
Yeah. One thing that I was really impressed with is it did not feel like I was on a netbook, where with, you know, traditional netbook-sized devices, although a lot of those are even smaller, like 9 or 10 inches.
Right.
But this thing was like, it felt like a full-size computer in terms of typing and using it.
Right, it's a regular keyboard.
Has a full-size trackpad. I think it's just as big as the MacBook ones.
Right.
It was impressive. Very, very light, very thin. A couple downers, though. One is that the 11-inch one, you can only get 128 gigabyte SSD in it. That's the biggest you can
get. What was the 13? Was it like 250 or something?
The 13 starts with the 128. You can go up to a 256. Okay. The other downer is they took away the lighted keyboard.
Really?
Or the backlit keyboard.
So the keys don't light anymore?
No. which is a huge, huge mistake, I think.
I love that on my MacBook.
Yeah, me too. It's like one of my favorite features of my Dell. It was actually something that I was not going to compromise on with the when I bought this laptop, you know, a year right. and change ago. I wanted a backlit keyboard. I felt that was one of the most compelling features of the MacBooks, that when they came out with the lighted keyboard, it was just like you can be anywhere, you can see the keys better. It works really well. But yeah, and what makes it worse is that it had it. The older 13-inch version not only had a moving hard drive and had room for that, it also had room for this backlit LED.
So the newer 13 and 11 both don't have the
backlit? Both do not have
that it. That is weird.
Yeah, I'm not happy with that. I actually, when I looked at the new 13 and 11, I thought, I'm like, you know what? This thing is pretty slick. I could maybe, like, you know, my usage model of computers has kind of changed the last couple of years. I've switched to, like, basically a desktop replacement laptop. And my desktop is now converted into like a Windows home server. But I do most of my computing on my laptop. But I found over the last couple of years that sometimes I still enjoy sitting down at a desk, which obviously I could sit my laptop on. But I was thinking if I got like a small netbook and then use that for traveling, which is lighter, thinner, that sort of thing. And I could, you know, do all my powerhouse type computing on my desktop. So I thought, well, maybe a MacBook could fit into this model. And the lack of that lighted keyboard, I mean, it seems like such a simple thing, but I'm just like, oh, killing me.
I mean, it is useful because, I mean, we're both touch typers, but still, you got to know where to put your hands in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I could deal with some better like tactile feedback on the keyboard, like some more like almost like Braille bumps.
Right, like most keyboards have that one little bump on the index finger of the home keys.
Yeah, so you know where you're at. But, you know, trying to find, like, delete or, you know, some crazy key, like, insert or something.
Right, especially if it's an odd keyboard. Like, I'm looking at your keyboard on your Dell laptop, and that's odd compared to a normal desktop keyboard because of the placement of, like, the insert, the home, page up, page down. They're not in the normal spot.
Right, it's in the configuration. I think the first ones to start this configuration were, like, Gateway. It has the Gateway side, like, page up, page down, home, and end keys. The rest of everything is pretty much like a normal keyboard.
Right.
But yeah,
it's just
have
those extra keys.
But even on most laptops keyboards, the insert and all that stuff are in a weird place. So it's just harder to find things on a laptop compared to a desktop. So I think this was a bad move, and I'm disappointed. And I was thinking, you know, I hate to say it, Apple almost had me. Now that said, I still would probably just delete the OS X partition and load Windows 7.
That's what kills me. I still don't understand that.
Oh, I'm telling you, Windows 7 is such a great operating system.
Dude.
It's so awesome. I love everything about Windows 7.
I mean, I'm pretty sure you could do that anyways. You know,
that
probably wouldn't have been hard. You know, you had asked me a couple days ago if I ever ran boot camp.
Yeah.
And I thought about it because I do want to have Windows on this for that one application, Rosetta Stone, that I use. You know, trying to learn a new language. And so I only have the Windows version of it. So I just broke down and installed a virtual machine because I'm too afraid to use boot camp, modify my bootloader, my partitions. I don't want to blow away my Mac. I have too much stuff on there. I can't risk losing it.
Well, I mean, just back up your partition, right?
Yeah, but I got like the biggest hard drive you could get, and I have a lot of data. Like, it's going to take me forever if I have to back up stuff.
You mean you didn't partition it?
There's no option to partition.
There's no option to partition?
No, everything comes preloaded. You turn on a Mac, it's like instant hello, welcome screen.
So you don't
register.
Format your Mac when you get it?
No, it comes with everything. Dude, whenever you buy a Mac, you are up and running within 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, so are you with a Dell, but I still delete everything and like format it the way.
But that's because Dells suck and they preload crap software.
No, I do it because I make a data partition and an OS partition, and that way when the OS partition blows up, I can get the data off of it from another place.
Ah, partitions don't blow up. Hard drives blow up.
Well.
And then you're still screwed.
I guess.
But yeah, there's no option for that whenever you're... You can do it after the fact with boot camp, you know, but whenever you get it, there's no option. So,
you almost had me, Apple. Almost.
I really like the Air. I haven't touched it, but just from watching other people touch it.
It's really light. It's strange. It has a really, like, it has a dense, like, metal, like, feeling to it, you know.
Well, it's the same unibody case.
Yeah, but it's also like it feels like it's hard to describe. It's dense, but yet it feels like feather light. Like it feels like a very quality piece of hardware.
That's what everybody's saying. They're saying that the MacBook Air is like super strong and sturdy, even more sturdy than the regular MacBooks.
Yeah.
They're like the MacBooks with the unibodies, they sometimes crack, but the Air is like, you know, throw it off a wall.
Yeah.
Whatever. They're just so expensive. I'm not paying $1,000 for one, for the cheapest one.
Yeah. Crap. They almost had me.
Man, too many things that I want to buy. So that is it for this week's Longcast. As usual, if you want us to talk about a story, you find something out there you think is cool and you want to make sure we talk about, just make sure you bookmark it on Delicious and bookmark it with the tag Slongcast019. Next week's episode will be episode 19. You can find me on Twitter and Facebook. My username is Slongcack. You can find Ryan on Facebook and Twitter. His username is Ryan Lancey. And I hope that you all have a wonderful Wednesday evening.